The Phantom of the Opera by Gaston Leroux. Produced by Audio Concepts of New York City. Performed by Patrick Horgan. Author's Introduction, in which the author of this singular work informs the reader how he acquired the certainty that the opera ghost really existed. The opera ghost really existed. He was not, as was long believed, a creature of the imagination of the artists, the superstition of the managers, or the absurd and impressionable brains of the young ladies of the ballet, their mothers, the boxkeepers, the cloakroom attendants, or the concierge. No. He existed in flesh and blood, though he assumed all the outward characteristics of a real phantom, that is to say, of a shade. When I began to ransack the archives of the National Academy of Music, I was at once struck by the surprising coincidences between the phenomena ascribed to the ghost and the most extraordinary and fantastic tragedy that ever excited the minds of the Paris upper classes, and I was soon led to think that this tragedy might reasonably be explained by the phenomena in question. The events do not date more than 30 years back, and it would not be difficult to find at the present day, in the foyer of the ballet itself, old men of high repute, men upon whose word one could absolutely rely, who would remember as though they happened yesterday the mysterious and dramatic conditions that attended the kidnapping of Christine Daae, the disappearance of the Vicomte de Chagny, and the death of his elder brother, Count Philippe, whose body was found on the bank of the lake that exists in the lower cellars of the opera, on the Rue Scribe side. But none of these witnesses had, until that day, thought that there was any reason for connecting the more or less legendary figure of the opera ghost with that terrible story. The truth was slow to enter my mind, puzzled by an inquiry that at every moment was complicated by events which at first sight might be looked upon as superhuman, and more than once I was within an ace of abandoning a task in which I was exhausting myself in the hopeless pursuit of a vain image. At last I received the proof that my presentiments had not deceived me, and I was rewarded for all my efforts on the day when I acquired the certainty that the opera ghost was more than a mere shade. On that day I had spent long hours over the memoirs of a manager, the light and frivolous work of the over-sceptical Moncharmin, who, during his term at the opera, understood nothing of the mysterious behaviour of the ghost, and who was making all the fun of it that he could at the very moment when he became the first victim of the curious financial operation that went on inside the magic envelope. I had just left the library in despair when I met the delightful acting manager of our National Academy, who stood chatting on a landing with a lively and well-groomed little old man, to whom he introduced me gaily. The acting manager knew all about my investigations, and how eagerly and unsuccessfully I had been trying to discover the whereabouts of the examining magistrate in the famous Chagny case, Monsieur Foret. Nobody knew what had become of him, alive or dead. And here he was, back from Canada, where he had spent 15 years, and the first thing he had done on his return to Paris was to come to the secretarial offices at the opera and ask for a free seat. The little old man was Monsieur Foret himself. We spent a good part of the evening together, and he told me the whole Chagny case as he had understood it at the time. He was bound to conclude in favour of the madness of the Viscount, and the accidental death of the elder brother, for lack of evidence to the contrary, but he was nevertheless persuaded that a terrible tragedy had taken place between the two brothers in connection with Christine Daae. He could not tell me what had become of Christine or the Viscount. When I mentioned the ghost, he only laughed. He, too, had been told of the curious manifestations that seemed to point to the existence of an abnormal being residing in one of the mysterious corners of the opera, and he knew the story of the envelope. But he had seen nothing in the story worthy of his attention as magistrate in charge of the Chagny case, and it was as much as he had done to listen to the evidence of a witness who appeared of his own accord and declared that he had often met the ghost. This witness was none other than the man whom all Paris called the Persian, and who was well known to every subscriber to the opera. The magistrate simply took him for a visionary. I was immensely interested by this story of the Persian. I wanted, if there were still time, to find this valuable and eccentric witness. My luck began to improve, and I discovered him in his little flat in the Rue de Rivoli, where he lived ever since and where he died 5 months after my visit. I was at first inclined to be suspicious, but when the Persian, with childlike candour, had told me all that he knew about the ghost, and handed me his proofs of the ghost's existence, including the strange correspondence of Christine Daae to do as I pleased with, I was no longer able to doubt. No, the ghost was not a myth. I have, I know, been told that this correspondence may have been forged from first to last by a man whose imagination had certainly been fed on the most seductive tales. But fortunately, I discovered some of Christine's writing outside the famous bundle of letters, and on a comparison of the two, all my doubts were removed. I also went into the past history of the Persian and found that he was an upright man, incapable of inventing a story that might have defeated the ends of justice. This, moreover, was the opinion of the more serious people who at one time or other were mixed up in the Chagny case, who were friends of the Chagny family, and to whom I showed all my documents and set forth all my inferences. In this connection, I should like to print a few lines which I received from General D. Sir, I cannot urge you too strongly to publish the results of your inquiry. I remember perfectly that a few weeks before the disappearance of that great singer Christine Daae, and the tragedy which threw the whole of the Faubourg Saint-Germain into mourning, there was a great deal of talk in the foyer of the ballet on the subject of the ghost, and I believe that it only ceased to be discussed in consequence of the later affair that excited us all so greatly. But if it be possible, as, after hearing you, I believe, to explain the tragedy through the ghost, then I beg you, sir, to talk to us about the ghost again. Mysterious though the ghost may at first appear, the ghost will always be more easily explained than the gruesome story in which malevolent people have tried to picture two brothers killing each other who had worshipped each other all their lives. Believe me, etc. Lastly, with my bundle of papers in my hand, I once more went over the ghost's vast domain, the huge building which he had made his kingdom. All that my eyes saw, all that my mind perceived, corroborated the Persian's documents precisely, and a wonderful discovery crowned my labours in a very definite fashion. It will be remembered that later, when digging in the substructure of the opera preparatory to burying the phonographic records of the artists' voices, the workmen laid bare a corpse. Well, I was at once able to prove that this corpse was that of the opera ghost. I made the acting manager test this proof with his own eyes, and it has now become a matter of supreme indifference to me if the papers pretend that the body was that of a victim of the Commune. The wretches who were massacred under the Commune in the cellars of the opera were not buried on this side. I will tell where their skeletons can be found, in a spot very far removed from that immense crypt, which, during the siege, was stocked with all sorts of provisions. I came upon this track while in the act of looking for the remains of the opera ghost, which I should never have discovered but for the great stroke of luck described above. But we will speak again of the corpse and of what should be done with it. For the present, I must conclude this very necessary introduction by thanking Monsieur Mifroy, who was the commissary of police called in for the first investigations after the disappearance of Christine Daae, Monsieur Remy, the late secretary, Monsieur Mercier, the late acting manager, Monsieur Gabriel, the late chorus master, and more particularly, Madame la Baronne de Castelbarbezac, who was once the little Meg of the story, and who is not ashamed of it, the most charming star of our admirable corps de ballet, the eldest daughter of the worthy Madame Giry, now deceased, who had charge of the ghost's private box. All these have been of the greatest assistance to me, and thanks to them I shall be able to reproduce those hours of pure love and sheer terror in their smallest details before the reader's eyes. And I should be ungrateful indeed if I omitted, while standing on the threshold, of this dreadful and veracious story to thank the present management of the opera, which has so kindly assisted me in all my inquiries, and Monsieur Massager in particular, together with Monsieur Gabion, the acting manager, and the most amiable of men, the architect entrusted with the preservation of the building, who did not hesitate to lend me the works of Charles Gagné, although he was almost sure that I would never return them to him. Lastly, I must pay a public tribute to the generosity of my friend and former collaborator, Monsieur G. L. Croze, who allowed me to dip into his splendid theatrical library and to borrow rare editions of books by which he set great store. Gaston Leroux. The Phantom of the Opera. Chapter 1. Is it the ghost? It was the evening on which Messieurs Debienne and Poligny, the managers of the opera, were giving a farewell gala performance to mark their retirement. Suddenly the dressing room of La Sorelli, one of the principal dancers, was invaded by half a dozen young ladies of the ballet who had come up from the stage after dancing Polyeucte. They rushed in amid great confusion, some giving vent to forced and unnatural laughter, others to cries of terror. Sorelli, who wished to be alone for a moment to polish up the speech which he was to make to the resigning managers, looked round angrily at the mad and tumultuous crowd. It was little Jeanne, the girl with the tip-tilted nose, the forget-me-not eyes, the rose-red cheeks, and the lily-white neck and shoulders, who gave the explanation in a trembling voice. "It's the ghost," and she locked the door. Sorelli's dressing room was fitted up with commonplace official elegance. A pier glass, a sofa, a dressing table, and a cupboard or two provided the necessary furniture. On the walls hung a few engravings, relics of the dancer's mother, who had known the glories of the old opera in Rue Le Pelletier, portraits of Vestri, Gardel, Dupont, Bigottini. The room seemed a palace to the chits of the corps de ballet, who were lodged in common dressing rooms, where they spent their time singing, quarrelling, smacking the dressers and hairdressers, and buying one another glasses of cassis, beer, or even rum, until the call boy's bell rang. Sorelli was very superstitious. She shuddered when she heard little Jeanne speak of the ghost, called her a silly little fool, and then, as she was the first to believe in ghosts in general, and the opera ghost in particular, at once asked for details. "Have you seen him?"
"As plainly as I see you now," moaned little Jeanne,
whose legs were giving way beneath her, and she dropped into a chair. Thereupon little Giry, the girl with eyes black as sloes, hair black as ink, a swarthy complexion, and a poor little skin stretched over poor little bones, little Giry added,
"If that's the ghost, he's very ugly." "Oh, yes," cried the chorus of ballet girls.
And they all began to talk together. The ghost had appeared to them in the shape of a gentleman in dress clothes, who had suddenly stood before them in the passage, without their knowing where he came from. He seemed to have loomed through the wall.
"Pooh," said one of them, who had more or less kept her head, "you see the ghost everywhere."
And it was true. For several months there had been nothing discussed at the opera but this ghost in dress clothes, who stalked about the building from top to bottom like a shadow, who spoke to nobody, to whom nobody dared speak, and who vanished as soon as he was seen, no one knowing how or where. As became a real ghost, he made no noise in walking. People began by laughing and making fun of this spectre, clad like a man of fashion or an undertaker, but the ghost legend soon swelled to enormous proportions among the corps de ballet. All the girls pretended to have met this supernatural being more or less often, and those who laughed the loudest were not the most at ease. When he did not show himself, he betrayed his presence or his passing by accidents, comic or serious, for which the general superstition held him responsible. Had anyone met with a fall, or suffered a practical joke at the hands of one of the other girls, or lost a powder puff, it was at once put down to the ghost, the opera ghost. Yet who had actually seen him? You meet so many men in dress clothes at the opera who are not ghosts. But this dress suit had a peculiarity of its own. It clothed a skeleton, a At least so the ballet girls said, and of course it had a death's head. Was all this serious? The truth is that the idea of the skeleton came from the description of the ghost given by Joseph Bouquet, the chief scene-shifter, who had really seen the ghost. He had run up against the ghost on the little staircase by the footlights, which leads straight down to the cellars. He had seen him for a second, for the ghost had fled. And to anyone who cared to listen to him, he said, "He is extraordinarily thin, and his dress coat hangs on a skeleton frame. His eyes are so deep that you can hardly see the fixed pupils. All you see is two big black holes, as in a dead man's skull. His skin, which is stretched across his bones like a drumhead, is not white, but a dirty yellow. His nose is so little worth talking about that you can't see it side face, and the absence of that nose is a horrible thing to look at. All the hair he has is three or four long dark locks on his forehead and behind the ears." This chief scene-shifter was a serious, sober, steady man, very slow at imagining things. His words were received with interest and amazement, and soon there were other people to say that they too had met a man in dress clothes with a death's head on his shoulders. Sensible men, hearing the story, began by saying that Joseph Bouquet had been the victim of a joke played by one of his assistants. And then, one after the other, there came a series of incidents, so curious and so inexplicable that the very shrewdest people began to feel uneasy. For instance, a fireman is a brave fellow. He fears nothing, least of all fire. Well, the fireman in question, I have the anecdote, which is quite authentic, from Monsieur Pedro Gaillard himself, the late manager of the opera, who had gone to make a round of inspection in the cellars, and who seems to have ventured a little further than usual, suddenly reappeared on the stage, pale, scared, trembling, with his eyes starting out of his head, and practically fainted in the arms of the proud mother of little Jam. And why? Because he had seen, coming towards him, at the level of his head, but without a body attached to it, a head of fire. And, as I said, a fireman is not afraid of fire. The fireman's name was Pimpin. The corps de ballet was flung into consternation. At first sight, this fiery head in no way corresponded with Joseph Bouquet's description of the ghost, but the young ladies soon persuaded themselves that the ghost had several heads, which he changed about as he pleased. And, of course, they at once imagined that they were in the greatest danger. Once a fireman did not hesitate to faint. Leaders and front row and back row girls alike had plenty of excuses for the fright that made them quicken their pace when passing some dark corner or ill-lighted corridor. Sorelli herself, on the day after the adventure of the fireman, placed a horseshoe on the table in front of the stage doorkeeper's box for everyone who entered the opera other than as a spectator to touch before setting foot on the first tread of the staircase. This horseshoe was not invented by me, any more than any other part of this story, alas, and may still be seen on the table in the passage outside the stage doorkeeper's box when you enter the opera through the yard known as the Cour de l'Administration. To return to the evening in question. "It's the ghost," little Jam had cried. An agonizing silence now reigned in the dressing room. Nothing was heard but the hard breathing of the girls. At last, Jam, flinging herself into the furthest corner of the wall, with every mark of real terror on her face, whispered,
"Listen."
Everybody seemed to hear a rustling outside the door. There was no sound of footsteps. It was like light silk gliding along the panel. Then it stopped. Sorelli tried to show more pluck than the others. She went up to the door and in a quavering voice asked, "Who's there?" But nobody answered. Then, feeling all eyes upon her, watching her least movement, she made an effort to show courage and said very loudly, "Is there anyone behind the door?" "Oh, yes, there is, of course there is," cried that little dried plum of a Meg Giry, heroically holding Sorelli back by her gauze skirt. "Whatever you do, don't open the door. Oh, Lord! Don't open the door!" But Sorelli, armed with a dagger, which he always carried, turned the key and drew back the door, while the ballet girls retreated to the inner dressing room, and Meg Giry moaned, "Mother, mother!" Sorelli looked into the passage bravely. It was empty. A gas flame in its glass prison cast a red and sinister light into the surrounding darkness, without succeeding in dispelling it, and the dancer slammed the door again with a deep sigh. "No," she said, "there is no one there." "Still, we saw him," Jeanne declared, returning with timid little steps to take her place beside Sorelli. "He must be somewhere, prowling about. I shan't go back to dress. We had better all go down to the foyer at once for the speech and then come up again together." And the child reverently touched the little coral finger which she wore as a charm against bad luck, while Sorelli stealthily, with the tip of her pink right thumbnail, made a St. Andrew's cross on the wooden ring which adorned the fourth finger of her left hand. She said to the little ballet girls, "Come, children, pull yourselves together. I dare say no one has ever seen the ghost."
"Yes, yes, we saw him just now," cried the girls. "He had his death's head in his dress coat, just as when he appeared to Joseph Bouquet." "And Gabriel saw him too," said Jeanne, "only yesterday afternoon in broad daylight."
"Gabriel? The chorus master? Why, yes, didn't you know?"
"And he was wearing his dress clothes in broad daylight."
"Who, Gabriel?"
"Why, no, the ghost."
"Certainly. Gabriel told me so himself. That's what he knew him by. Gabriel was in the stage manager's office. Suddenly the door opened, and the Persian entered. You know, the Persian has the evil eye."
"Oh, yes," answered the little ballet girls in chorus, warding off ill luck by pointing their forefinger and little finger at the absent Persian, while their second and third fingers were bent on the palm and held down by the thumb.
"And you know how superstitious Gabriel is," continued Jeanne. "However, he is always polite, and when he meets the Persian, he just puts his hand in his pocket and touches his keys. Well, the moment the Persian appeared in the doorway, Gabriel gave one jump from his chair to the lock of the cupboard so as to touch iron. In so doing, he tore a whole skirt of his overcoat on a nail. Hurrying to get out of the room, he banged his forehead against a hat peg and gave himself a huge bump. Then, suddenly stepping back, he skinned his arm on the screen near the piano. He tried to lean on the piano, but the lid fell on his hands and crushed his fingers. He rushed out of the office like a madman, slipped on the staircase, and came down the whole of the first flight on his back. I was just passing with Mother. We picked him up. He was covered with bruises, and his face was all over blood. We were frightened out of our lives, but all at once he began to thank Providence that he had got off so cheaply. Then he told us what had frightened him. He had seen the ghost behind the Persian, the ghost with the death's head, just like Joseph Bouquet's description."
Jeanne had told her story ever so quickly, as though the ghost were at her heels, and was quite out of breath at the finish. A silence followed, while Sorelli polished her nails in great excitement. It was broken by little Giry, who said, "Joseph Bouquet would do better to hold his tongue."
"Why should he hold his tongue?" asked somebody.
"That's Ma's opinion," replied Meg,
lowering her voice and looking about her, as though fearing lest other ears than those present might overhear.
"And why is it your mother's opinion?"
"Hush! Ma says the ghost doesn't like being talked about."
"And why does your mother say so?"
Because... nothing."
This reticence exasperated the curiosity of the young ladies, who crowded round little Giry, begging her to explain herself. They were there side by side, leaning forward simultaneously, in one movement of entreaty and fear, communicating their terror to one another, taking a keen pleasure in feeling their blood freeze in their veins.
"I swore not to tell," gasped Meg.
But they left her no peace, and promised to keep the secret, until Meg, burning to say all she knew, began, with her eyes fixed on the door.
"Well, it's because of the private box."
"What private box?"
"The ghost's box. Has the ghost a box? Oh, do tell us, not so loud," said Meg. "It's box 5, you know. The box on the grand tier, next to the stage box on the left." "Oh, nonsense, I tell you it is. Ma has charge of it.
But you swear you won't say a word. Of course, of course.
Well, that's the ghost's box. No one has had it for over a month except the ghost, and orders have been given at the box office that it must never be sold.
And does the ghost really come there?
Yes. Then somebody does come? Why, no. The ghost comes, but there is nobody there.
The little ballet girls exchange glances. If the ghost came to the box, he must be seen, because he wore a dress coat and a death's head. This was what they tried to make Meg understand, but she replied,
"That's just it. The ghost is not seen. And he has no dress coat and no head. All that talk about his death's head and his head of fire is nonsense. There's nothing in it. You only hear him when he is in the box. Ma has never seen him, but she has heard him. Ma knows, because she gives him his program."
Sorelli interfered.
"Giry, child, you are getting at us."
Thereupon little Giry began to cry.
"I ought to have held my tongue, if Ma ever got to know. But it's true enough. Joseph Bouquet had no business to talk of things that don't concern him. It will bring him bad luck. Ma was saying so last night."
There was a sound of heavy and hurried footsteps in the passage, and a breathless voice cried, "Cécile! Cécile, are you there?"
"It's Ma's voice," said Jam. "What's the matter?"
She opened the door. A respectable lady, built on the lines of a Pomeranian grenadier, burst into the dressing room and dropped groaning into a vacant armchair. Her eyes rolled madly in her brick-dust-coloured face.
"How awful!" she said. "How awful!"
"What, what?"
"Joseph Bouquet."
"What about him?"
"Joseph Bouquet is dead."
The room became filled with exclamations, with astonished outcries, with scared requests for explanations.
"Yes, he was found hanging in the third-floor cellar." "It's the ghost," blurted little Giry, as though in spite of herself.
But she at once corrected herself, with her hands pressed to her mouth.
"No, no, I didn't say it. I didn't say it."
All around her, her panic-stricken companions repeated under their breaths,
"Yes, it must be the ghost."
Sorelli was very pale. "I shall never be able to recite my speech," she said.
Ma Jam gave her opinion, while she drained a glass of liqueur that happened to be standing on the table.
"The ghost must have had something to do with it."
The truth is that no one ever knew how Joseph Bouquet met with his death. The verdict at the inquest was natural suicide. In his Memoirs of a Manager, Monsieur Moncharmin, one of the joint lessees who succeeded Messieurs Debienne and Poligny, describes the incident as follows. A grievous accident spoilt the little party which Messieurs Debienne and Poligny gave to celebrate their retirement. I was in the manager's office when Messier, the acting manager, suddenly came darting in. He seemed half mad and told me that the body of a scene shifter had been found hanging in the third cellar under the stage, between a set piece and a scene from the Roi de Lahore. I shouted, "Come and cut him down!" By the time I had rushed down the staircase and the Jacob's ladder, the man was no longer hanging from his rope. So this is an event which Monsieur Moncharmin treats as natural. A man hangs at the end of a rope, they go to cut him down. The rope has disappeared. Oh, Monsieur Moncharmin found a very simple explanation. Listen to him. It was just after the ballet, and leaders and dancing girls lost no time in taking their precautions against the evil eye. There you are. Picture the corps de ballet scuttling down the Jacob's ladder and dividing the suicide's rope among themselves in less time than it takes to write. When, on the other hand, I think of the exact spot where the body was discovered, the third cellar underneath the stage, I imagine that somebody must have been interested in seeing that the rope disappeared after it had effected its purpose. And time will show if I am wrong. The horrid news soon spread all over the opera, where Joseph Bouquet was very popular. The dressing rooms emptied, and the little ballet girls, crowding round Sorelli like timid sheep around their shepherdess, made for the foyer through the ill-lit passages and staircases, trotting as fast as their little pink legs could carry them.